It's time for The Car Doctor on AM 950 WROL. Got a car question? Call us at 617-770-3030. That's 617-770-3030. Now, here's The Car Doctor, John Paul, on AM 950 WROL, the spirit of Boston.
And good Saturday morning, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Car Doctor program on AM 950 WROL, the spirit of Boston. I thought I couldn't hear myself there for a minute. It's that tricky microphone button. Yeah.
Sorry, getting back in the swing of things.
Yeah, again. I know. You've been, yeah. All right. So, anyway, welcome to the Car Doctor program. It is a chilly 5, 6, 7, 3 degrees. It's chilly out. You know, I don't, wherever you are, it's... when I left the house, it was about 4. On the way here, it dropped to 3. In Marina Bay, I think it's 7. It's busy.
It's busy. Just cold.
It's cold. It's cold. You're right.
It's freezing. It's not chilly. It's freezing. Yeah. It's brutally cold. Do not go out if you don't have to. Just listen to us for the rest of the morning.
There you go. Good idea. Listen to us, then listen to the Irish Hit Parade. It'll all be good. So, welcome to the last show of the year, the last program of the year here on AM 950 WROL, the spirit of Boston, or if you're listening on Sunday night, AM 1260 WBIX. You can give us a call. We do have a guest lined up. We'll be talking to him in just a bit. Gunther Berman, he is the founder of the Newport Auto Museum, so we'll be talking to him in just a bit. We'll also be keeping you up to date on what's happening in the automotive industry and as well as a review of the little Kia Rio hatchback. So we'll be talking about that as well. So we got a lot of things. Got a lot of things going on. So everything should be, you know, coming up the way it's supposed to come up. As I was walking in the building this morning, one of the guys at the building here said to me, "Oh, did I see you on Chronicle the other night?" Yes, you may have. It was a rerun. It was from a couple months ago. But yes, I was on Chronicle the other night talking about electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles and all kinds of other stuff. With us on the phone is Gunther Berman. He is the founder of the Newport Auto Museum. When we think about auto museums here in New England, you know, we think about Owl's Head, maybe Lars Anderson, Heritage Plantation, and Wells. But the Newport Auto Museum's new. Good morning, Gunther, and welcome to the Car Doctor program here in Boston.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And first off, how'd you get the name Newport Auto Museum? That was some very good marketing.
Well, actually, it's a Newport Car Museum.
Oh, okay.
Newport Car Museum.
All right.
.org. It's a not for profit, yep. And Newport, you know, has been a great historic attraction for lots of things, the mansions, et cetera. And with that kind of traffic, we figured that doing a good-sized car museum like ours, 50 cars, 110,000 square foot building, would be an attraction as people wended their way down to Newport to see the other attractions.
Yeah, absolutely. Every time, and I work for the AAA, our office is in Providence, and every time it seems like the topic turns to cars, people ask me, you know, about the Newport Car Museum, and, you know, have I been there yet? What's it like? You have created quite a buzz.
Well, we're so happy that we could put a museum of this type in the area. As you know, USA Today has just nominated us in the last month as one of the 10 best new attractions in America, which, you know, we were floored by that designation. But, you know, we've tried to put together a museum that appeals to everyone. We sort of start in 1954 and go to the latest and the end of the Viper line in terms of Chryslers and a new NSX. And so we've got some new cars, old cars, 5 different galleries, Ford, Shelby, every Corvette model from the C1 to the C7, and looking forward to the new ZR1. World cars with Porsches and Jaguars and BMWs and Mercedes and NSXs, and then the thin car area, which is a sort of a walk down memory lane for people. You know, the 50s big thin cars, including a 59 Cadillac and a 57 DeSoto, and then Mopar with a Hemi Cuda and a Hellcat and a bunch of Vipers, including a 70 Superbird that goes beep beep when he's horn. So we have an attraction, hopefully, for everybody's interest in automobiles. Mainly what we're looking for is cars that are really works of art. And unlike most car museums where there's a lot of velvet ropes separating the cars with big signs, this, our museum, you can walk around the cars and look inside, and they're on platforms, no barriers, and you can take pictures and things. So we've had over 15,000 visitors since we opened June 1.
And, you know, being nominated for one of the best new attractions, I mean, really shows that you have not just created a great space, but you've created a great space that appeals to a lot of different people. And like you said, as you just ran through the different types of vehicles that are there, you really do. I mean, you appeal to multiple generations of car lovers.
Well, we have a lot of interactive. We have in each of those galleries, there's a little vignette of video that you can sit and watch some of the history of the particular cars in that gallery. Plus, we have a simulator room with eight simulators, so you can take any car out in any racetrack in the world and race it yourself. So after a visit to the museum, if you're so inclined and excited about the visit and want to go drive on faster than you can on the highway, we have a venue affords people the opportunity to do that as well.
Well, no speeding tickets.
Well, we give virtual tickets. I have a virtual body shop, so if you crash any of my cars in the simulator room, I send you a virtual bill.
Well, as long as I can send you virtual money back, it's all fine. Yeah, it's not going to be Bitcoin, by the way, just so you know. So, where do the cars come from? Whose cars are they?
Well, they're all mine, and they come from various places. You know, I purchased them off eBay. I purchased them at auctions. I purchased them from private collections and things. So it comes from a myriad of different sources, and I'm sort of a serial collector. So we get sort of new cars all the time and sell the ones that. We try to improve the breed on a regular basis to have the best cars.
Yeah, and I guess if you have more than one of something, you're a collector. So,
I guess that's the case. Yeah, the first, this would be of interest to the gearhead part of your audience, and that is that the first weekend of every month we have hoods up at the museum, so you can go not only and look at the beautiful art that those cars are, but also look at the mechanics, because the hoods are up and you can take a look at the engines, which I think are in many cases almost as beautiful as the cars.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was your first collectible car?
Well, my first collectible car, which is now in the galley, it's a convertible. I had a hardtop. My first car that I purchased myself for $295 was a 57 DeSoto. Mm. And I drove it to my construction job, took it to the drive-in with a bunch of my buddies and hoped to beat the dollar head charge. I slept there a few times, but I didn't get home in time and things. So it was collectible, but also very utilitarian. Mm.
Actually,
my first real collectible car, I inherited from my uncle. It was a 66 289 Mustang convertible.
What I like about the listing of cars in your collection is I understand every one of them. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day, and they were we were talking about collector cars, and they were talking about some cars, Brass era cars, and that's a little early for me. You know, those are cars that I don't necessarily, I get them, I understand why people love them, but the cars that you have in your collection are cars that I've known my whole life one way or another.
Well, that's one of the points. When somebody said, why don't you have any pre-war cars? And really, I try to appeal to an audience that now, you know, a grandfather, his son, and his grandson can come in and see something that they really enjoy. And brass-era cars, many of the people who love those cars have sort of aged out or are no longer with us. And so we really try to stay current. And as I say, we have everything from, you know, the 54 Skylark and the 54 Corvette to the latest thing off the assembly line. I appreciate those brass era cars and, you know, the Model T's and things. I think they're wonderful, but I do think that you know, it's a bit like the Renaissance. The Benetti's sponsored Michelangelo to do all these wonderful works of art during the Renaissance, and when the 50s came along, there were no De Benetti's, but the car companies had a lot of money and hired these wonderful artists and stylists and designers who created some of the most iconic cars that we have. And at a time when you can differentiate what cars look like today, in some respects, it's many of the cars are, I call them appliances, like refrigerators. You can't tell the difference between a lot of the models. That being said, I think this is an amazing era of slow cars. Again, I mean, when you can go to a showroom and buy a Hellcat that's 707 horsepower, or even a new Demon that's 840 horsepower. Even though we have this appliance, I call appliance cars out there, there's remarkable automobiles being built these days.
There are, but I think you're right. There's some remarkable cars. The technology's remarkable, but they are pretty traditional, you know, kind of three box cars. So, you know, I'm looking out in our parking lot now, and there's a Camry, there's a Corolla, there's a Hyundai, there's a, you know, another Toyota.
How can you tell?
Yeah, well, it is a little hard to tell, and you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
So, you know, with the exception of, you know, like you said, you have one of every Corvette from the C1 to the C7. You know, I think those, you know, GM, for the most part, had you know, a certain amount of style in those, and I have to admit, it took me a while to warm up to the new Corvette.
But again, if you kind of take a look at the lines and what they're doing, despite the fact that we love to see C1 through C4, C5, the new one is a special work of art as well.
Yeah, and you said the Acura NSX. The NSX is a beautiful car.
I think you probably know that it was designed by a woman.
Yeah.
Who worked for BMW, and it took them 10 years to get it right, I guess. And it's a remarkable car. I call it my poor man's 918 Porsche. You know, electric motors on the front wheels, one on the back, and 500 horsepower.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing automobile.
Yeah,
technology is spectacular.
Yeah, you're right. Compared to the Porsche, you saved $200. You saved $800,000.
Well, maybe even more.
Yeah. When you're in town, do you open the door and take a car for a ride?
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the things when we designed it, each of the platforms has a ramp, so we can take the cars out, and I do take them out. And, in fact, we just got a 67 GT 350 with a Paxton supercharger, pretty rare car, beautifully stored. And it came off the truck, and I drove it around for an hour or so. And as I'm coming back to the museum, this gentleman is walking out the walkway, and I sort of recognize him. We start to talk, and he was one of the first members of the museum. We have memberships. And I said, what are you doing? And he goes, well, I'm just on my way home. I spent a little time at the museum because I'm a member, and I always like to come back for an hour or two. And I said, well, if you're not doing anything, hop in. So we went for a ride in one of the cars that's now in the exhibit. So we had lots of fun with the cars. And, you know, I'm trying to get a demon so that every Saturday morning, we don't have quite a quarter of a mile, but we have an eighth of a mile every Saturday morning. We can take it out and woo our fans that come to the museum by lighting up.
I thought for a minute there when you said you were the car came off the truck and there was somebody coming out of the museum. I thought it was going to be your new Newport neighbor, Jay Leno.
Oh, that would be great. I would hope that he would bring some cars from his hangars in Burbank or wherever he keeps his cars, to Newport and lets the people of Newport and the tourists that come down see some of his vehicles at the Newport Car Museum. That would be great. I know some members of his family have been to the museum, but he is not yet. I don't know whether he's closed on his house. But he's a great addition to the Newport community, I think, especially because of his interest in cars and our interest in cars. So I'm sure we'll get together at some point.
Well, Gunther, I want to thank you for taking some time out of your Saturday morning. But before we do that, is there a link on the website to the voting? The voting's just about over, but is there a link on the website to vote for the museum as the top pick for the USA Today poll?
Yeah, if you go to NewportCarMuseum.org and just scroll down the page, there's a place to vote there. Currently, we're trailing Evel Knievel and Elvis. It would be nice to beat one of those guys.
Yeah, I got to think you can beat Evel Knievel. You know, it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough to beat Elvis, but
I think so.
Yeah.
I think because of the season, the Bible Museum might be ahead of us too. So, but I would appreciate anyone who would be to vote. And the wonderful thing is that you can vote, like they say in Chicago, early and often. You can vote every day. So anyone who would vote for us, that would be great. We'd love to, you know, stay in the top 10 of the best attractions in America. We're the only car museum, and I think we're the only attraction in the Northeast. So it benefits everyone if we do well in that polling, I think.
Well, I haven't been there yet, but I owe it to myself to get there and check out the museum, check out the cars. The hours of operation are
10 to 4. In the summer it's 10 to 6, and on weekends it's generally 10 to 6, but it's 10 to 4 these days when it's 3 degrees outside.
Yep.
But I welcome you to come, and I'd be happy to give you a private tour, or maybe you can, with all your knowledge of automobiles, maybe you can give me a tour, tell me exactly what we have. But I'm pretty confident that you'll enjoy yourself. Most people spend actually between an hour and a half and 2 hours going through. A part of that, obviously, is racing on the simulators and watching some of the movies and looking at the cars. So I welcome anyone to come. The admission is $18 for adults. And we have a special for seniors and military at 15. So
there you go. And the actual address for the museum is?
Well, it's 1847 West Main Road. It's the Raytheon campus.
Yep.
As you come down West Main Road on the 24, and we're the building right along the road. You'll see the signs out in front, but as you come through the guards gate, which looks ominous, but is wide open, just make a left, and we're the big building in front of you.
Sounds fantastic. Gunther, again, thank you for joining us here on the Car Doctor program here in Boston, and I look forward to coming to visit the museum and, try to stay warm, I guess. So.
Well, we look forward to having you, and you stay warm, too, and let us know when you're coming down, and as I say, we'll we'll roll out the red carpet for someone who's as knowledgeable of tires as you are, and let's have some fun.
All right. Thank you very much, and have a wonderful and happy and safe new year.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
All right. Good luck. Bye-bye. That was Gunther Berman. He is the founder of the Newport Auto Museum. The idea of his took his collection and built a museum around it, which is pretty impressive. The only other person, what was his name? The guy who did the Miami Auto Museum. He had one name. He was like Madonna, and. English guy, and he owns the Miami. It's kind of a museum restaurant, and he said in England he has 500 personal cars in his collection, and but he parks all his cars around. It's like kind of almost a tent structure in Miami, and it was free to go and see the cars, but it was $1,500 a table to eat. So a little out of my price range. So like most of Miami is. So yeah. So why don't we take a break, pay some bills? My name's John Paul. This is the Car Doctor program. It's the last Car Doctor program of the year. So why don't you give us a call at 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. We'll be right back.
Well, my time went so quickly, I went lickety-splitly out to my old 55. As I pulled away slowly.
And welcome back to the Car Doctor program at AM 950 WROL. I feel more settled in now. My headphones were too loud. I couldn't get to the. I know it's all. I get a lot of problems in my life. What can I say? Well, I thought I'd take a little time and talk about the car that got me here today, which is the 2018 Kia Rio hatchback. The all-new Kia Rio comes in both a four-door sedan and a hatchback. There are three trim levels: LX, EX, and S. All are powered by the same 130 horsepower, 1.6-liter four-cylinder engine. Manual and automatic transmissions are available in all trim options. Our road test was in the EX hatchback version with an automatic transmission. In these days where nearly every engine is developing 300 horsepower, the Kia Rio with only 130 may sound underpowered, but it actually performs pretty well. I think it's that combination of six-speed automatic transmission, the way they have the engine tuned, works out pretty well. On city streets or out on the highway, at speeds of at least up to 65 miles an hour, the Kia Rio does pretty well. I mean, I've been driving it back and forth to work, out on the highway, performs well. It's also pretty good as far as quiet. You know, you don't feel like you're in a true economy car, even though that's really what it is. It isolates you from road noise and bumps, and they stretched the wheelbase out as far as they could go with it, which helped improve the ride, so there's no choppiness, which is kind of nice. For an economy car, like I said, it's reasonably quiet. The Rio is also a nimble, good-handling small car that, like I said, rides pretty well. The seats are reasonably comfortable, even after a few hundred miles of driving. At 6 feet tall, I had pretty decent head and leg room. The controls are straightforward and simple. Our test car had Android Auto and Apple CarPlay. And I don't know what you know about Android Auto and Apple CarPlay, but the idea that you can sync your phone, and I have a iPhone, like 60% of the people that have phones, I guess, and I plugged it into the port, and I could use at least, I don't know, a half a dozen of the apps on my phone in the car, including navigation, which means that the navigation system is always up to date because the maps on my phone are always up to date. So it displays on the 7-inch screen, and it works pretty well. If I wanted to listen to Pandora in my 8 music selections in Pandora, or wanted to listen to the music that's already on my phone, right through the system, works good. Also, I have TuneIn Radio as an app, and it brought up the TuneIn app, which means I can listen to radio stations all around the country, including this one, and including the Car Doctor podcasts, which are also on TuneIn. So I heard myself, which I never really like doing, but they load automatically on TuneIn. But there is a little tiny radio station in Florida that I listen to, and it's in the town where, well, if I ever live there, that's the town I live in, I think there's one employee, the guy who owns it, and I don't think it's a very powerful station. I think it's almost like a school station. I think it's maybe 25 watts or something. But it's actually fairly interesting because they do actually have weather and traffic reports and what's going on in town. And the idea that I'm listening to it here in my car when the station's 1,500 miles away and the quality's good is pretty good technology. Just like if you want to listen to this program and you're in Florida, and we've had some Florida residents call us before. And the idea that you can do that with an app and do it driving down the road is pretty good. So I really kind of like the Apple CarPlay app. And I've tried it in other cars, and for some reason, this car, it works extremely well. Other cars, it hasn't worked as well, but this one works really well. The rear seat has seatbelts for three. Yeah, three real people aren't going to fit in there. Three big people are not going to fit there. Three kids might fit back there. Yes.
How's the legroom?
In the back? If I move the front seat up a little bit, you could probably squish in the back. It's a little tight. It's a little tight. It's not as tight as, I mean, this is a small car. And when you're sitting in the front seat with the seats all the way back, you don't actually notice it's a small car. When you sit in the back seat, you go, oh, this is a small car. But when you sit in the front seat, you don't actually, it doesn't feel small. So if I had two adults back there, yeah, it's short trips. That's about all you'd want to do. Our buddy Jeff, who's here in the overnights, he gets off usually at 8 o'clock. And but when he stays a little bit later, I sometimes give him a ride to the T, and he would have fit okay in the back. He would have been fine for at least a short period of time. It seems like they spent all the money on getting the front seats comfortable and not as much about the back. This particular vehicle had a split folding rear seat, which isn't that way, I believe, in the base model. But at least you can put longer things in the back seat. Or in the trunk area or hatch area, whatever you want to call it, and still utilize the seat in the back so you can still carry at least three people. With the rear seat folded, cargo area is actually pretty good because it is a hatchback. There's a lot of room. And even with the seats up, there claims to be 14 cubic feet of cargo space, which isn't bad either. That's about the trunk of a lot of mid-sized cars. Fuel economy is also pretty competitive for a small car. EPA rates this car 29 city, 37 on the highway. The onboard trip computer says I've been averaging about 35.5 miles per gallon. So pretty good commuter car if you're getting 35 miles to the gallon with it. Although it's kind of funny. It's almost like unless you drive an SUV, a bigger SUV, smaller to mid-sized cars now, fuel economy is starting to come up. And we're starting to see a lot more cars that are showing, you know, 30, 31, 32, 35, 37 miles per gallon, which is good to see that because although I was going to say gas is getting cheaper or more expensive, depending where you go. The gas station, oddly, there's a BP station near my house, and they were one of the highest priced gas stations. Now they're one of the lowest priced gas stations. There's a Citgo station near my house that's the highest. The independent guys have went down, then they went back up again. So gas prices are bouncing all over the place. So bottom line, the Kia Rio stacks up well against competition such as the Honda Fit and Ford Fiesta, so kind of put it in that category size-wise. Add in Kia's warranty and overall price. If you're looking for a subcompact car, the Rio by Kia should be at the top of your list. Base price, $13,900. Price is tested, so with Apple CarPlay, you know, pretty much all the bells and whistles. If I had to add one whistle or one bell this time of year, seat heaters. Or maybe remote car start. There is no need to go start your car on a cold morning unless you want to be warm. But as far as actually adding to the longevity of your car, by the time you get out and start it and settle in, so put your seatbelt on, adjust the controls, find WROL on the radio. That's really all the time you need to warm up your car. But you need to drive it easily until the car comes up to temperature. A lot of people think in cold weather, well, I need to go out and warm up my car so it makes the engine last longer. The problem is you've warmed up the engine, but you haven't warmed up the transmission. You haven't really warmed up the differential. You haven't warmed up the brakes. So you're much better off getting in the car, starting it up, and just driving like it's a brand new car until it comes up to temperature. In fact, some cars, Toyota, Volkswagen, maybe even Subaru, there's a blue light that comes on when it's really cold. And that's a light that tells you, take it easy until the car comes up to temperature. And that's what adds to longevity of vehicles. With this cold weather, a lot of other people, and I did a couple of TV interviews in the last couple of days, and people said, what do you do? And I said, well, hopefully you've been doing this a long, you know, you should have been prepared for this kind of weather, but people haven't been. We've been averaging almost 1,000 road service calls an hour. 60% of those calls are for cars that don't start. So dead batteries, whatever. The second ones have been for tire related. And then the third ones are for people who went out to start up their cars and warm them up and then lock their keys in their car. We've been doing a fair amount of those. So... and a lot of times when people buy a used car, especially with these new expensive keys, a lot of times you only get one key. So I recommend to anybody who goes out to buy a used car, if the second question they should ask, I guess, whatever the first one is, I'm not sure, but the second question they should ask, does the car come with two keys? And if it doesn't, say, I'm really interested in the car, but I want a second key and a second remote. Because you should have one, and they can cost several hundred dollars or more, depending on the car. But a lot of people say, well, I don't really know about my car, so I want to go out and I'm going to go out and start it every couple hours just to make sure it starts when I need it. Not a great idea, because every time, and this is sort of a little bit of an old wives' tale sort of thing, but every time you start a car, it takes about 5, 6, 7 miles of driving to recharge the battery for the amount of electricity you've taken out of it. And on a cold day, on a 30-degree day, it takes about 30% more energy to crank the engine over because the oil's a little thicker, the parts are cold, the starter's cold. So it's going to take a little more energy to crank the engine over. At 0 degrees, your 600-amp battery might only be capable of 300 amps. So on a really cold day, if you go out and every few hours and start up the car and just let it sit there for a minute and go, oh, okay, it started. If you keep doing that, by the time you really need your car on, say, Tuesday morning after the Monday holiday, it may not start because you've actually taken away electricity from the battery and never replenished it. So you're actually better off just letting it sit until you actually need to go out and start it rather than go out and periodically restart it. Better off you would be go out and drive it every couple of days and take it out for a 20-minute, 30-minute drive. So go get go get milk and eggs or whatever people do.
I got a couple questions.
All right.
Related to this very subject. My Rogue.
Yes.
Is very sluggish in this cold weather to start. It ramps up to over 3,000 RPMs, yep. Whatever that.
Yeah. All right.
And it takes a few minutes for it to get going and stuff like that. And Is that something I should be concerned with, or just is that something that's normal?
It shouldn't be sluggish. I mean, you should get in it, turn the key, push the button, whatever makes it start, and it should start up. It should rev up a little, calm back down, and that should be it.
Okay.
Shouldn't do anything. I mean, you could give it a little gas, tap the gas a little bit. But other than that, that's really all that should happen.
Okay. And now, based on some things that are going on, there's two cars down in the Cape that have been in the garage, mm-hmm. That have not been started, at least in a few weeks anyways. Mm-hmm. Should they be started at least once in
a while? I would try to start them every 3 weeks,
okay,
month at the most,
okay,
and then take them for a half an hour drive. So, and if you can't do that, at least start it up, drive it to the end of the driveway, put it in reverse, back up, do that a little bit to sort of exercise the transmission, and that way it gets all the fluid circulating around. But the best thing is starting it up and driving it. That would be the best thing.
Okay.
So a lot of times what happens, especially people that put cars into storage, they'll go out every week or so, start it up, and just let it run. Well, really all you've done when you start a car up, there's always, even a modern car, there's always a little extra fuel. And that extra fuel is designed to go, that doesn't get burned. It gets mixed in with the oil, and when the oil gets up to temperature, it sort of burns off all those contaminants. So condensation, fuel, everything that goes on inside an engine. Well, if all you do is start it up and go, let it run for a minute. Yeah, okay, it seems fine. I'll shut it off. You've added contaminants to the oil. So in that case, you're better off, let it just sit there and don't worry about it. What I would do, until you figure out what's going to go on, is I would go and get both cars, start them up, go to any store and get something called gas stabilizer. Stabil is a one, STABIL. They actually have a marine version. It's kind of a blue color. I tell myself it's better because it costs a dollar more. And go put Stabil in both cars, and it'll take like maybe 4 ounces in each car. And that keeps the fuel from going bad. So add that, fill up the gas tanks, go back. The other thing you should do is, depending if you're in any kind of a wooded area, you need to watch out for critters, mice and such. And some cars are much more appealing to critters than others. Some cars use, instead of using petroleum byproducts to cover the wiring harnesses and the seat foam, like most foam is made out of some form of petroleum, a lot of cars today are using soy-based products. And apparently soy-based foam and soy-based wire tastes good to mice and stuff. And they can chew through things and cause lots of trouble. So what I would do is, while you're out warming up the cars and getting stable and stuff, I would go to a hardware store, and you can get these. They look like tea bags, but they're filled with oil of spearmint. And kind of that way, it's not like mothballs that stink. This smells like Lifesavers. And put them around inside the engine compartment, maybe even one inside the car, and a couple in the garage. And that's going to keep that, they claim, will keep mice away. Other people say use like downy dryer sheets. But you just don't want, you don't want critters taking up residence in there, because they will chew the wires. And I was, I heard something on the news the other day, some woman who lives in Boston, and she came out and her car wouldn't start. She had it towed to the garage, and rats actually were living in it and ate up her wiring harness. So she figured it was just a one-time thing. Happened again. And she ended up having the car towed to her summer home, wherever her summer home is, just so that wouldn't happen. But the idea that, they can. So, yeah. And the other thing you might want to do is, every tire has a maximum inflation pressure, so 35 pounds, for instance. Max out the tire pressure, because while the car's sitting, they're going to lose a little bit of air. So where you might normally keep 30 or 31 pounds or 32 pounds of air, run them right up to 35. You know, if you went a little higher, 36, 37, you're not going to hurt anything. That way, it's going to help. Other than that, maybe crack the windows open a little bit so the car can kind of breathe. And then just when you, you know, then you'll be in a little bit better shape. You may still find that if you don't do anything, you've done this, you put it away, and you didn't get back till June, you may find that you're going to have to jumpstart the car or charge up the battery, whatever the case is. But that's pretty much, you know, and where it's sitting in a garage, you have less issues with rust that can build up on brake systems, but you still will get some. So if when you go to leave the driveway, you're going to drive out and you're going to step on the brakes and you're going to hear. It's not that the brakes suddenly wore out. They just have rust on them. Yeah. So that's what I would do. At least give it a shot. See what happens. So nothing. You looked like you were about to press your button. So I just, but anyway, so that, you know, that's what I would try to do. And that will help. So again, if you're going to keep your car outside in the wintertime and you're worried about what to do, to maintain it, to make sure it will start on, especially, when it comes to making sure that your car is, going to start on, maybe you have a 2 or 3 car household and one car is not being used because somebody went on vacation for the week. Those are the kind of problems that can certainly happen. And, you want to be able to take care of that. Our phone number is 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030, and let's talk to Tom. Tom, is that you?
Yes, that's me.
Hey.
How are you doing, John?
Good, how are you?
Happy New Year. Hope everything goes well. Question for you. First of all, I want to thank you for all your help over the year. I've called for little things here and there, and it's been a lot of help, so I want to thank you for that. My next question is, how do you remote start electric car to warm it up so it's not cold outside?
Well, they actually have timer systems in them, which will actually turn on. I mean, they have heaters in them, so even though it's an electric car, but they have heaters in them, so you can actually set them to, and best they're best done when they're plugged in if they're charging up. That way, you're not taking away any of the battery capacity. So, so you can set them up so it, you know, a half an hour before you go to use a car, the heater comes on and warms up the car and turns the seat heaters on. And all you're doing then is you're just pulling from your electricity at your house or the charging station and not pulling from the electricity on the batteries. So,
in what form of heat do they have? Was it an electric heater or something?
Usually
sort?
it's an electric heat pump system. So it's not like a radiant heater, like a electric wire that gets hot. Most of them I've seen use a, like a, almost looks like a heat pump that, you know, you would have like a small version of what's in a hotel room kind of thing. So it makes heat, air conditioning. Yeah.
Now you're very pro electric cars. I just wondered how come you don't own one as of yet? Price ratio?
Yeah. The one that I would want to buy, I would have to have Bobby Brooks money. And Bobby Brooks just walked in. That's why I said it. So, the thing about I like the idea of an electric car. I think they're pretty interesting, but I also like the idea of being able to drive, you know, a couple hundred miles without having to worry about it. And with the exception of the new Chevrolet Bolt and a Tesla, you're sort of limited. Even the new Nissan Leaf is about a 150-mile range car, which isn't bad. But still, you know, if I look at my typical commute, you know, I commute 100 miles or so round trip back and forth to work. So most of the electric cars that are on the market right now that I would consider somewhat affordable, I can't, you know, they wouldn't work for me.
Okay.
And to be honest with you, I'm looking to replace one of our cars now, and you know, my budget is, you know, probably under $25,000, not under $45,000. So, it is the cost relationship of what I'm going to get, you know, for my money and what will work best. And I think the electric cars right now, not quite there for me. I went for a ride in a Tesla, fantastic car, great power and performance. In fact, the car doctor from former car doctor emeritus, I guess, from WTIC Radio in Hartford. He just recently bought a Tesla, and he's a guy who keeps his I think he has a Volkswagen that's maybe a 2010. Prior to that, I think he had a 1985 Volvo. So he keeps his cars a long, long, long time. And he decided to buy a Tesla, and I think for a couple of reasons. I think he was looking at the big tax deduction you can get, the $7,500 tax credit. And he also has a lot of photoelectric stuff at his house. And he's got a four-car garage, so he can, you know, keep it inside, plug it in. He has it just plugged into, you know, something that doesn't look any different than a dryer outlet. And he can keep it charged up, and it's pretty efficient for him. So
now, where does the cost ratio from electric to gasoline, which one is ahead? I mean, will you get, you know, people say, oh, I got an electric car, it doesn't cost me that. Well, that's not true. Where does that break? The only thing I see where the electric car advantage is that there's a lot of free places right now, the incentive, like you could go some travel, and that maybe right now is a good time for that. But what about the cost of the car versus the, you know, the price of the electricity?
No, if you had to compare a Chevy Bolt to a similar size car that got 35 miles per gallon, it's pretty hard, because even, you know, the average price per kilowatt hour is about 15 cents plus all the other stuff they add to it. So, you know, if it's got a 60 kilowatt hour battery in it, and it costs you say 20 cents for easy math to charge it up, and you can go 250 miles, well, it makes it sound like it's a pretty good deal. But on the other hand, you're paying $15,000 more or $20,000 more for a similar size car. So especially if you looked at something like a Chevy Cruze versus a Chevrolet Bolt, and you said, well, one gets 35 miles per gallon, the other costs me 20 cents per kilowatt hour, but I have $20,000 to spend on gasoline. It's a hard number to make it make sense.
Right. If you took that Volt, what car would you compare that to? Taking away the electric part of it versus, you know, a gas car is drivability, comfort, all the features.
Yeah.
What car would you kind of compare that to in cost?
Yeah, in the Chevrolet Bolt with the B, not the V, the Bolt with the B, which is fully electric, I would, it's a small four-door sort of hatchback-y sort of car. So I don't know. I mean, maybe the Kia Rio that I'm driving. It's a little taller than that, but maybe. So
difference in cost now.
$20,000 grand. $20,000 different cost. And even if you said, well, the electric part of it makes a ton of sense, and I'm paying very little for electricity, especially if I can charge up for free, $20,000 buys a lot of gasoline.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's where you are at. Yeah. That's the way I look at it. But I get a lot of debates with people, and they say that dollar for dollar, it's really not there.
Yeah. And the other, you know, but every once in a while, when gas prices go up, you know, gas prices all of a sudden go from $2 to $3 a gallon, and people trade in their Ford Explorer and buy a Ford Escape because it gets 10 more miles per gallon. But that doesn't make any sense either, because they just traded in a car that they might own and bought a car that cost them $25,000. And it's like, okay, I got $15,000 on my trade-in. I traded in that car. I got a new car, but I had to pay $10,000 more. If there was nothing wrong with the old car, again, $10,000 buys a lot of gasoline too, and, you know, would buy 10,000 more gallons of gasoline. But people do that all the time. So,
just for the newity too. But I'm in the same line as you, thinking about electric cars. When I see it, I just say, if I'm going dollar for dollar, in numbers it still don't work. If I'm a green, you know, well, that's different. But
in
the middle.
Yeah, you know, it's my boss. Well, he's leaving, kind of. Mark Shaw, the guy who is the president of AAA, he was looking for a luxury American car, and he looked at the Lincoln. He didn't really like it. He had bad experiences with Cadillac, and he's like, but I want to buy an American car. I like American cars. And he ended up buying a Tesla, because not just because it was electric. He found that kind of as a novelty. But he's like, I like the style. I like the quality inside of it. I like the performance of it. And so I got what I wanted. I got a performance luxury car that kind of stands out from the crowd a little bit. And it's, you know, and it satisfied everything I wanted it to satisfy.
Right, right. Yeah, I hear you. I agree. Well, yeah. You know, one thing on the gas, like the ad stable, let me say, I have a couple old vehicles around. Yeah. I fool around with. And I put them aside, and I a year later, I start them up, and there's no issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I haven't seen that problem. I've seen that problem on small motors,
yep.
like I have, chainsaw,
yep.
or, you know, something like that. But I haven't seen it on these, and I've taken them apart, and I'm not really seeing that issue. And
yeah.
there's not many cars, to
yeah.
be honest with you.
I look at stable for a car that you put away because it's $6 and it can't hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now,
I
like to believe the ethanol in, you know, as bad as ethanol is in gasoline, I like to believe that the ethanol helps a little bit, but then it also collects moisture at the same time. So it's kind of a, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword that it does some good and then does some bad at the same time. So I like the idea of, you know, if I had a car that I cared about and I wanted to put it away, you know, buying a $6 bottle of stable or something like that and throwing it in there, to me, it can't hurt. And the other thing it does, some of the stable products, Stable 360, actually they claim that it, as it evaporates in the gas, it actually coats the inside of metal gas tanks and keeps them from rusting.
Yeah, oh, that's important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, thank you very much,
all right,
John.
Take care.
You
see
you. Yeah, bye-bye.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Let's talk to Rick. Rick?
Hey there, John.
How are you?
Okay. Now, you mentioned taking a vehicle out every, you know, few days in that just for, you know, keep it running in that.
Yeah, for a good 20-minute exercise.
I would question you on that at this time of year with motorcycles.
All right. I saw a guy yesterday on sort of a dirt bike looking thing, you know, so like a big dirt bike, like a 350cc
yeah.
sort of, you know, that sort of almost on-road sort of bike. And he was wearing a snowmobile suit, and all I can imagine is his real car didn't start.
Well, there's actually some people that actually all they own is a motorcycle.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But
you know, and God bless them to do it because, you know, a guy I work with, kind of, who works in Florida, has a big Yamaha, and that is his vehicle, and he rides it year round. Now Florida is not that hard to ride year round, but he rides it rain or shine, and that is his primary vehicle. And you know, he lives about 20 miles from work, but that's the only vehicle he has. And he takes it fishing. He takes it, you know, out on his kind of family trips. Him and his wife. And they do have another car, but for the most part, all they have is, you know, all he has is his motorcycle and rides it year-round. Again, you know, the coldest temperatures he's going to see is 30, maybe, so.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you the truth, wind chill at 30 is pretty, you know,
yeah.
pretty cold.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, if you have a motorcycle, leave it till a nice day. Just charge it up once in a while.
Well, I thought I bust your chops a little bit with that
right.
one.
That's all right. I need that. All right,
okay,
Rick.
Now
a real question?
Question?
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, now the last time my wife and I had a dispute, you sided with her. So I hope you do better this time around.
Well, we'll see who's
and
right.
That, yeah, and now, you know, on a cold day like it is right now, which does your car end up warming up faster when you climb in and immediately turn the heater on and have it blowing whatever's coming out of the vent at that point, or you wait until you see the temperature indicator move off the cold line and then you turn your heater on?
Well, in the olden days, you would be better off, and not even just the old days, but in some cars still to today, leave the heater off until the engine starts to come up to temperature, because what happens is it actually shuts off the flow of water through the heater core. So basically what it's done is it's shortened up the cooling system a little bit, which makes the engine run a little hotter. Just like when your car starts to overheat, what do they always tell you to do? Turn the heater on, because now you're circulating water through the cooling system, through the heater system, which helps cool the water off. So for the most part, keeping the heater off for a couple of minutes until the engine starts to warm up, then turn the heat on, in a lot of cars works. But today's cars, a lot of today's cars, the water's running through the heater system whether the heat's on or not. When you turn the temperature control knob, what you're really doing is you're opening up a door that goes from fresh air to hot air. So I don't want to turn the fan on full blast when there's only cold air coming out. That's just going to make me colder. So I might turn the heat knob all the way up, turn the fan all the way off, and I might even push the recirc button, which will typically steam up the windows a little bit. But I'd push the recirc button so you're not getting cold air coming into the car, and I'll drive that way for a couple minutes, shut the recirc button off, then turn the fan on and get a little bit of heat.
Well, you did a nice job of staying in the middle.
Oh, there you go. There you go. I'm a good fence walker for that. Okay.
Okay, John. Have
All
a good
right.
one.
You too. Happy New Year. Bye-bye. Our phone number, 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. We have a couple lines open now if you want to join us. Let's talk to John in Peabody. John?
Good morning, John.
How are you, sir?
Cold.
Cold. I hope the heat's on, at least.
I got a 2006 Camry, new battery, and I got the remote start. And sometimes I start the car from the house. I go out and the car started. Sometimes it doesn't start. Any suggestions?
Do you know, have you ever gotten close enough to it to see when it doesn't start, if it does anything?
Yes. Doesn't. And then when I go in the car with the key in it,
yep.
You know, turns over, you know, really.
Yeah. But does it? But if you went out there and you hit the, like a lot of times you got to hit the lock button and then the remote start button, or you have to do a little bit of a trickery to it to get it to go. Does it try to start? Does it crank over? Does just nothing happen?
Nothing.
Okay. It may have a key bypass. So in other words, the key to your car has a security feature built into it. And what you do is you take that extra key and you wrap this coil thing around it and you tuck it away underneath the dash somewhere, and that way the system always thinks there's a key in the car. Now it may be it's that thing is starting to act up a little bit.
No, I got that key in my wallet.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah.
So you don't need an extra key. So it doesn't. Your car doesn't have a security key then.
No.
No. Okay. Then, I don't know. It could be just a remote start unit starting to go bad.
All right. One more question. When you're driving in the wintertime, your windows are closed, your heater is mm-hmm. on. How do you tell if you got any carbon monoxide fumes in the car?
When you fall asleep.
Too late.
Oh yeah, that's right. Oh yeah. You can't. Carbon monoxide is colorless, odorless. The chances of getting carbon monoxide in a car are pretty slim for the most part. If you were really concerned about it, you could get a battery powered carbon monoxide detector and put it in the car and see if you were getting carbon monoxide. There was a recall back, a year ago maybe, with Ford Explorers, specifically the police package Explorers, that they mounted so many brackets and things in them that they were getting carbon monoxide into the vehicles. And even at that, I kind of question a little bit, because the tailpipe comes out pretty far on that, so, and the exhaust isn't going to have a leak in it, so why, you know, how would you get carbon monoxide in it unless you sat with the car just, you know, backed into something and sat it and let it just idle and idle and idle and idle? Could you get some carbon monoxide up through the floor of the car? But the idea of driving down the road and having carbon monoxide get into the car with all the windows closed, not very likely. If you had maybe an SUV that you could crack open the rear window somehow, or an SUV that you drove around with the tailgate open. I don't know why you would do that. Could the carbon monoxide from the tailpipe come up and get sucked back in? Sure could, but in a closed vehicle, not very likely. Now, if you put the car in a garage, absolutely, but in a closed vehicle driving down the road, it'd be pretty unlikely. I've seen more people have reactions to mold and mildew in cars than I have to carbon monoxide. But if you have a concern about it, you can, you know, for $20, go buy a carbon monoxide, battery-powered carbon monoxide detector, throw it in the car and see if it goes off.
All right, then. Well, if you're only half as good as in 2018 as you're in 2017, you're still a 10 in my book.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that.
Happy New Year.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. We have some lines open if you'd like to join us. Dennis is over there doing some work. And, what was that noise? I don't know. I think I fixed it. Whatever that noise was, I think I fixed it. So there's a picture. I don't know. This guy got, I guess, pulled over by the police up in Vancouver, British Columbia. He had a tablet and a smartphone bungee corded to his steering wheel. And also looks like a navigation system or something, but it says, automakers can't bring autonomous vehicles to market soon enough. It seems that some people simply can't drive without distractions anymore. It's getting dangerous with all the multitasking going on behind the wheel. Last month, police in Vancouver, British Columbia, pulled over a driver only to discover he'd been using string to latch his tablet and an iPhone to the steering wheel of his Lexus. The cop says, can't make this stuff up. Guy had an iPad and an iPhone attached by strings to the steering wheel while driving. Yes, that's the ticket he's holding, the Vancouver Police Department tweeted with a picture. After the stop, the driver was stopped because he was wearing headphones, according to the report in the Vancouver Sun. Police issued the driver a $81 Canadian ticket for failing to produce a license, but did not issue a distracted driving ticket, which carries a fine of $280 and 4 demerit points, the paper reported. Just when I think I've seen everything, Vancouver Police spokesman Jason Doucette told the paper. Doucette said the ticketing officer decided educating the driver about the hazards of distracted driving would be more effective than a ticket. I disagree. I think the ticket would have been more effective, but I don't know. I mean, I, if you follow me on Facebook or Twitter, I posted a picture from the state police yesterday that supposedly the guy was Bill. The guy's name was Bill. He was stopped out on the Mass Pike, and he only cleaned about 2 inches of or 3 inches of snow off his windshield. And I can't remember the Dustin something is a state trooper, and he's their social media guy, and I follow him on Twitter. He puts some funny stuff out about some of the stuff they see, and his thing is, he didn't come out and say Bill's an idiot, but he should have. But he said don't be like Bill, and they gave Bill a ticket. So I think they need to do that. Let's talk to Mike in Revere. Michael.
Yes. Good morning, Dr. Paul.
Good morning.
I'm anticipating, it's always a pleasure to listen to your show, very informative, I appreciate it. In any event, I'm anticipating storage of my 06 Avalon for about 3 months. Now, having listened to your program on numerous occasions, I understand you're an enthusiast of a stable.
I think it's gasoline. I think it's a good product. First off, where are you going for 3 months?
I'm going to Florida.
Good for you. What part?
Fort Lauderdale area.
Fort Lauderdale. Good for you.
I have a quick question in regards to this. I'm storing the automobile.
Yep.
Does it matter as well if I disconnect the positive or the negative terminal in the battery, sir?
I would disconnect the negative one. And
okay.
It really doesn't matter. But here's why you always disconnect the negative battery first. Because if you have a wrench in your hand and it's on the negative battery post and the wrench mistakenly hits something else, nothing will happen. If you put the wrench on the positive battery post and loosen it up and the wrench happens to hit something metal, what's going to happen? You're going to have a big spark and short, and bad things are going to happen.
Maybe blow out the alternator or something.
Well, I mean, or you know, melt the wrench to... Sure. to the car. Okay. So yeah, so always disconnect the negative first, because you can't do any damage to yourself. You're not going to cause
sparks. I'll leave the negative terminal disconnected for the period of time that I'm gone.
That's fine. That's fine.
And does it have any effect on the radio station?
It may, or I hate to say may or may not, but it may or may not. You may find that when you come back, everything's going to be like a brand new car. It's all going to, all the radio stations going to be on 88.1, and the clock's going to say 12 o'clock. On the other hand, I've disconnected some batteries, and as long as nobody touches anything, there's a little capacitor circuit in some radios that store electricity and hold some of that memory. And you might get lucky. Cool. You might come back. And don't be surprised when you come back and you hook the battery back up, if it needs a jump start to get going, if the car doesn't run perfectly when you come back, because it has nothing to do with anything. It's just the computer in the car has also lost its memory. So what's going to happen is you're going to start the car up, and it may run a little bit rough for a minute until the computer learns to make some corrections. And then as you drive it for the next couple of minutes, it's going to straighten itself out. But if you first start it up and go, wow, it's not running good, don't be worried until you take it for a ride. And it may take shutting it off and starting it up a couple of times for it to feel normal.
Okay. Thank you very much, Doug.
All right. Good luck and enjoy Florida and stay off of that. What's that real expensive street down in Fort Lauderdale?
Las Olas.
Yeah, stay off Boulevard. Yeah, stay off of that street. It'll cost you too much money.
It'll cost too much money to go there, that's for sure.
All right.
Take care, Mike.
Yep, bye-bye.
Need your help. Bye now.
617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. Let's talk to Chip. Chip.
Hi, good morning, John Paul. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The heater in my wife's car, she's got a 2010 Chevy Impala. There's never a good time, but this is definitely not a good time. Been checking it out. I've got the blower's not working. There's no power to the heater control unit at all, it appears, because I've pressed the rear defrost and it usually lights up.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no power there. I'm thinking it might be the resistor going to the blow motor. Would that be a good bet?
That usually what happens when the resistor for the blower motor goes bad, you usually have high speed on the fan only.
Right. It's just totally dead.
Yeah.
Nothing whatsoever.
I would start, by, have you done all the normal stuff, checked all the fuses and...
Yes.
Yep.
Check the fuses. The one thing I did cherish doing right now is getting outside there and crawling, because I know I have to drop the panel. It's on the inside of the passenger side.
Right.
Underneath the glove box.
Yep.
And the resistor's right there, and so is it the blower motor. I was just hoping that, one maybe would take care of them both.
It's easy enough. It's easy enough to check if you got power to that, but like I said, normally every blower resistor that I've seen, when it goes bad, you still have, and it's sort of what, you think about what the resistor does when it's on low, medium, what it does, that resistor uses some of that current to run the fan a little bit slower. When it's on the high speed setting, it bypasses the resistor completely. So it would be odd that you wouldn't have high. Is there more than one fuse panel on that car? One like under the hood and one under the dash?
There's one under the hood and there's one under the dash.
Yeah.
The one under the hood was checked. Do you think it might be something under the dash?
Yeah,
because
I would.
There's no power to the rear defroster either.
Yeah, if there's no power to the rear defroster, you have another problem going on there. So it's odd.
Okay.
Yeah, because those. Yeah, I think you just have a fuse out somewhere.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will go start hunting. I checked, there's two locations for the fuses, and yesterday when I went out to check it, albeit later in the day, I was hoping it was gonna get warmer, but no avail.
Yeah.
The ones underneath the hood were good, but I didn't check the ones inside per se, but now they're in the cluster, it makes sense.
Yeah. How are you checking the fuses? Are you using a test light, or are you just visually looking at them? What are you doing?
I just visually looked at them.
Yeah,
with my son.
I would at least
he's got better eyes than
Yeah.
Me.
I would at least, if you have it, use a little 12 volt test light, or even a multimeter if you have it. And you can even you can even use the multimeter on the resistance side and just measure the resistance. Most multimeters will handle a 20 amp draw or circuit without any real problems. And you could just go across the fuse with it and just make sure that you have good resistance, and that's going to check the resistance through the fuse and the circuit a little bit, so you're going to kind of know what's going on. If not, just get an inexpensive 12 volt test light and at least check the fuse to make sure it's okay. I like I said, I'm willing to bet you have a bad fuse, or bad, I suppose you could have, even though your car is going on 8 years old, it's too new to have some kind of wiring problem.
Right.
Yeah. I kind of think you're going to find a fuse that's out.
All righty. Well, okay. Thank you very much for your time. I find your show's very informative. Thanks again.
All right. Take
care. Appreciate
it. Bye-bye now.
Yep. Bye-bye.
617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. Let's talk to Mike in Bridgewater. Michael?
Good morning, John.
Good morning, sir.
Good, sir. I just wanted to start by wishing you and your family a joyful New Year.
Thank you.
I hope you had a good Christmas and that Santa was good to you. In this climate with the really cold snap we're having, what's your feelings about adding dry gas to the gas tank?
Give me the dollar instead.
Okay.
Yeah, because... if you keep your gas tank mostly full, so more than a half a tank, and you don't let the car sit for really, really, really long periods of time, I don't think you really need to use it, because most dry gas is either isopropyl alcohol or methanol alcohol. Don't drink either of them. They're not good for you. They're designed, the methanol alcohol ones are designed to mix with the water, and the alcohol and the water mix together with the idea that now you can burn the water okay. The isopropyl alcohol ones are, the isopropyl mixes with the water, and then the mixture together then mixes with the gasoline, so it gets burned through the system as one part. Our gasoline all has ethanol in it. Ethanol, like all alcohol, tends to attract moisture, but on the other hand, it attracts it and kind of encapsulates it. So almost by design, the gasoline we have today has a dry gas in it. So the other thing is metal gas tanks. Metal gas tanks tended to build up condensation when they were empty. So when the gas tank was 3/4 empty, you would get a moisture vapor that would build up on the inside of the tank just because the metal tank was cooler and the gas was warmer, and it would build up a little condensation inside the tank. Plastic gas tanks, which a lot of cars have today, they don't build up the same moisture inside of them as the metal tanks do. So the real answer is keep the gas tank at least half full, and you shouldn't have any problems with moisture. And I think today gasoline antifreeze isn't really necessary.
Oh, that's great. And by the way, it's not a dollar anymore. It's $2.39.
Oh, geez.
Okay, may I just share with you, you were talking about, rodents in the cars when you put them up. I just learned of a situation where they went in and they ate the wire harness. And to replace the harness with the labor, how about $8,000?
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It was incredible when I was...
$8,000 to repair most damage.
Because the harness itself, but then the labor of getting all the way through, And finally, if I just may, you've talked about the fact you worked on Checker cab cars.
One of the garages I worked in, there was a younger woman who had a Checker cab, and she had it as her personal vehicle, and her family had more than one of them. And so they would come in as regular customers, and they were kind of goofy cars. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just going to ask you, cause my father had one. I'd kind of forgotten all about it, with the jump seats in the back, mm-hmm, and all that. But you mentioned something about that they came through with Is it whatever was
whatever?
It was like whatever
was the best deal. So you could get you could get a Ford alternator. You could get a Chevy alternator on one. The engines were kind of the same, but even the brake systems would change a little bit from. You know, you look at the cars, you go, well, they all look the same from the first one they made to the last one they made, except for the bumpers. Why do the brakes change that much? And it's not because they necessarily got better. It's just because it was kind of whatever the deal was, I think, the checker struck with whoever they were buying their supplies from.
Okay. Parts by committee, I guess.
I know somebody who has a checker now, and you know, their dream someday is to turn it into sort of a hot rod. So they want to put like a big engine under the hood and, you know, kind of make it look a little bit outrageous. I don't know if they'll ever do it. Right now it's just kind of sitting in the corner with the hood kind of half off of it. But you never know.
Yeah, you never know. Thank you, John. I appreciate
the show.
All right, take care.
Happy New Year.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's talk to Len in Billerica. Len. Len? Len? Len?
Oil.
Hey, there you are.
Yeah, okay. Synthetic oil?
Yes.
Yeah, how far can you go between changes, mobile, synthetic, four-cylinder?
I will tell you no longer than whatever the manufacturer tells you can.
Okay.
So in other words, if your car says change the oil every 5,000 miles, I would be a poor car doctor to say you could go longer than that. Because,
okay.
Because then you're being... contrary to what the owner's manual suggests for the vehicle. So never a good idea. Can you go, in reality, can you go once a year if you only drive 12,000 miles a year? And even though the car says, you know, change the oil every, you know, 7,000 miles, could you go once a year? Yeah, you probably could. The only way I would even consider doing that would be I would send the oil out for analysis every, you know, 4 or 5 months, and see if the oil has started to break down and was contaminated.
Okay.
Well, that's, you know, that if you're going to spend that much money, you might as well just change the oil. Our Volkswagen that we have says change the oil once a year or every 10,000 miles.
Wow.
You know, that to me, that's a long time. And we don't drive, it doesn't get driven 10,000 miles a year, but the oil gets changed once a year. And even that I feel a little bit guilty about.
Yeah.
Our older car that we have, the oil gets changed about twice a year, except for 2 years ago where it might have only got changed once. But it gets changed about twice a year, and I use synthetic oil in it. And I just like the way synthetic oil starts up on cold days. There's less tapping and, you know, engine noises, and I just think it tends to work better all the way around. So.
Yeah, okay. And what about should you stay with the same oil that the car came with? It's a fairly new car. It's a new car, a year old. But the dealer is using mobile. So
the dealer is probably using mobile because that's what he gets. There are some, you know, if you went out and bought a Corvette, for instance, it says, you know, equipped with mobile oil from the beginning. Well, you know, that's, you know, could you switch to Castrol synthetic oil? Sure you could. I think all synthetic oil is good oil, even to the point where with synthetic oil, I'll even buy the bargain brand from Walmart, and I've had pretty good luck with it. So, you know, you can go with pretty much whatever you want. And that's my story on synthetic oil. Our phone number again, 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030 is how you get through if you want to talk to us. I know Dennis disconnected somebody, so shame on him. I have a picture of, and this is what scares me, this is a picture of, I think it's Texas, and it's a new car dealership, and the floodwaters are up to the middle of the windshield. And it's a whole series of pickup trucks, and the floodwaters are up to the middle of the doors. And it says, storm-driven sales gains disappear. The story is about, you know, are people buying new cars? The real story here is, what's happening with all these cars and where are they going to go? So let's see. Dennis has got, he's got hearts and arrows now. Little things going on. Go here first. Let's talk to Paul in Somerville. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Hi, John. How are you?
Okay.
Happy New Year to you.
You can
happy
blame,
healthy New Year.
You can blame Dennis for disconnecting you.
That's no problem.
All right.
That's the least that happens. I'll be fine. I just want to let you know, you mentioned a few minutes ago about the Ford Explorers
yep.
and the carbon monoxide.
Mm-hmm.
You may or may not be aware, Ford has a program that is going to address that.
Yep.
Actually, my car was going to the dealer next Friday. But it says, in the interest of customer satisfaction, Ford Motor Company has authorized your dealer to reprogram the climate control module, inspect the rear of the vehicle, sealing and repair as necessary, free of charge, parts and labor,
mm-hmm.
under terms of the program. It's effective until December 31st, 2018, regardless of mileage, and coverage automatically transfers
mm-hmm.
to subsequent owners. So I didn't know if you were aware of that program, but that's out there.
No, I wasn't aware of that one. I mean, I was aware of the police version ones that Ford was saying, well, it's the issue is more how they mounted all the racks and stuff in the vehicle. But in a regular passenger vehicle, and this was about potentially carbon monoxide or something else?
That's what
yeah.
it says. It says
yeah.
Ford is aware some Explorer owners have concerns
yeah.
about exhaust or carbon monoxide.
Yeah.
Carbon monoxide.
Yeah.
And then it says emphasize the vehicles that are safe, but our investigation has found carbon monoxide levels that exceed what people are exposed to
yeah.
every day. However, your peace of mind.
Yeah.
That's what I can scan this letter and send
you
an email.
That'd be great. That'd be great. Because I wonder what they're doing with the climate control. I wonder if they're letting the fan run for a minute or so after the car shuts off to clean the air out of the car.
Yeah, I'm not sure. The letter states a half a day service, and when I called the dealer, one of the things that they emphasized is that we need the car all day.
Yeah,
and
that would be great if you could send it to me. That way, I might be able to find the actual technical bulletin that would explain why they're doing what they're doing. So,
I have the program number. If you're interested, program number 17N03.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah, but if you could scan it and email it to me, that'd be terrific.
Yeah, I'll scan an email to you this morning.
That'd be perfect. Paul, a pleasure as always.
All right, John. Take care.
All right,
take
care. You as well. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Paul from Somerville. I know he is one of the fans of the Irish Hit Parade as well. So he's our buddy. Let's go to Sal. Sal, is that you?
It's me. Okay, here's what I have.
All right.
About a year ago, about this year, the check engine light went on. Okay.
Yeah.
So I brought it to a local guy, and he put that scanner on there, and he said, "It's the thermostat."
Okay.
I said, okay. So I didn't change it, and everything was all right. So now, with this cold weather coming, I was up in New Hampshire 2 days ago, and it was hot for the thing to reach a temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And once it reached the temperature, it dropped back down. I don't know what it is. Is it the Maybe I should change the thermostat.
Yeah, yeah. Chances are why the check engine light came on before is the thermostat hung open a little bit, and the engine never really came up to operating temperature, and that was the code that says, you know, the code basically says engine not getting hot. And
right.
what happened was it probably just sort of freed itself up and worked okay. And now where the temperature got really cold and you didn't see the temperature gauge moving, well, the temperature gauge isn't probably not moving because there's coolant being circulated all the time. So,
okay, but,
yeah.
Okay, go ahead. Well, anyway, then my car's in a garage, and I rode my controller, started, you know,
yep.
in the morning, and then it starts going up, and it works.
Yeah, it's probably, I mean, the other possibility, even when the temperature gauge wasn't going up the way it should, what kind of heat did you get out of the car?
When it wasn't going out?
Yeah.
2 days ago, it was getting like, it was not hot,
but it was lukewarm.
Coolish hot, like,
lukewarm,
you know,
yeah.
Lukewarm, yeah. That's it.
Put a thermostat in.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. Put a thermostat in.
Okay.
Because
if you said to me,
I'm getting pretty good, I'm getting good temperature out of the car, but the gauge is acting wacky, I'd say, well, then it's probably a bad temp sensor. But where you're not getting good heat out of the car, I'm willing to bet the thermostat's bad.
Okay. Yeah, it goes up now.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I because set it up and I let it run.
Yeah.
And then it.
Yeah, but it's probably sticking. So I replace it. The worst thing that can happen to you is it does just the opposite. It sticks closed and the car overheats. So you're much better off replacing the thermostat now.
Okay.
Okay.
Right. That's what I'll do.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. Let's see if we get one more call in. Let's see if we got Brad on the phone. Brad, is that you?
Yes.
Yes,
sir. Morning, John.
Good morning.
I had a question on tires there. My daughter's got a 2008 Ford Fusion.
Yeah.
And the tires, every now, because of this extreme cold, it seems like they're losing air every couple of days. They're down to like 20 pounds, and I got to pump them up with.
Yeah. It's probably not the tires. It's probably the wheels. What happens is, I mean, you can, there's a couple things you can try, but what's probably happening is the wheel is not, the tire is not sealing on the wheel very well. Does it have aluminum wheels on it, shiny wheels on it?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's probably corrosion built up around the wheel where the bead of the tire sits, and that's probably why, is it all four tires or just one or two?
Four.
All four, yeah. You could go to a good tire store like Sullivan Tire. They could break the tires down. They'll clean up the wheels. They'll put some bead sealer on it. They'll put it back together, and that may solve the problem for you. But I've known people over the years that have had, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 year old cars, and the wheels have been corroded enough where you can't get them to seal at all anymore, and you end up having to replace the wheels. So, and it has to do with the, you know, change in temperature and the cold and all of that. You know, I'd because you know they're going to lose a little bit of air, I'd probably run them right up to the max pressure to, you know, 35 pounds, so you're not chasing it quite as often. But, yeah, you shouldn't be doing it, you know, every few days. There's something wrong. But I'm willing to bet, Unless she ran over four nails in the road, which is, you know, you never know. It's always possible. Somebody in her neighborhood could be having a roof put on or something, you know. And but if that wasn't the case, I'm willing to bet it is leaking around the bead of the wheel and the rim.
Yeah, because the tire place that I got them, they were saying like, oh, these rims are porous, they're cracked or something like this year, whatever.
It's possible, but I have seen, especially like I said, the guys at Sullivan Tire, I have seen them buff up the wheels. They put a commercial coating on it, a bead sealer on it, and that seems to do a pretty good job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was wondering, you know, these are like high mileage tires as far as, you know, the tires are rated by the rubber compound, like out of rubber and stuff like this here for the wear.
No.
I'm saying, like, oh, does that mean because they're using a better rubber compound that doesn't seal as good?
No. It's the bead edge is the bead edge. That's not going to change. So, I bet if you, well, don't do it today. I was going to say, go out with a spray bottle and some Windex or a little bit of soap and water in a spray bottle, spray it around the outside edge of the wheel. I bet you'd even see a little bit of tiny, tiny bubbles starting where the edge is between the bead and the tire.
Right.
Bead in the wheel, rather.
And then if you had to get replacement rims, what would you be buying? The same kind that you had on there?
You're going to buy, I mean, I probably wouldn't buy the Ford wheels because they're stupid expensive. I would probably go and try to buy just an aftermarket wheel that looks close. You know, I'd maybe go, you know, go to a tire store and look, or go to maybe even like Tire Rack and see what's available. But you're going to spend $100 a wheel. And up. Yeah. Hey, we got to get going. We're out of time. We're getting in the way of the Irish Hit Parade.
Happy New Year.
All right. Happy New Year to you as well. Hey, Bobby Brooks is here. He's right there in the studio. Right there. Absolutely right there. I see him.
Top of the morning, sir.
Top of the morning to you as
well. Happy New Year to you and your lovely bride.
It was kind of funny. I thought I saw Paul Sullivan pull up. I saw his car, and I'm like, it looks like Paul Sullivan's car. I'm like, maybe he changed his mind. So
no. Paul Sullivan is just fine. He had a follow-up procedure. He just needed another day or two or R&R, but he's doing great.
Great.
Talked to him yesterday. All the test results looked really good. So he'll be back next week. So,
good.
Yeah,
good, good, good.
Good stuff.
Well, you're here, which means it's time to go to work. It's time for me to stop work and you to go to work. The very best in Irish music right here for the rest of the afternoon into the evening with the Irish Hit Parade. Bobby Brooks filling in for the – Professor Paul Sullivan, I got to go. Happy New Year to one and all. Until next week, wear your seatbelt, drive safely, be good to your car. Talk to you all next week. Bye-bye.